We'll welcome everyone to this important session about the ongoing torture and oppression of refugees by the Australian state, and also about the ongoing struggle to survive for refugees locked up in Manus Prison and on Nauru, and also about the importance of building a solidarity movement here in Australia. My name's Liz. I'm going to be chairing the session today. I'd also like to acknowledge that this session, this conference, is taking place on stolen land, on the land of the Gadigal people, and we'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and also show our support for their ongoing struggle for self-determination. We are very lucky today to have with us on the phone Behrouz Bouchani. Behrouz Bouchani has been a leading voice of the prisoners, the political prisoners held on Manus, and he's here to speak to us about the situation on Manus and in particular about his new book that he's just published, which is called No Friend But the Mountain. He wrote this book by text message on mobile phone, which was a smuggled mobile phone that, getting the text messages out, incredible feat of both, bearing witness, also an incredible writings about the kind of Kafkaesque system, that's designed to try and destroy the humanity of people on who are imprisoned there. The book is translated by Omid Tofigan, who's actually a lecturer here at Sydney University, and the book is available on our bookstalls, only 7 left, but also in all bookstalls across the country. So Behrouz is going to be speaking via phone for about 10 minutes. It's raining on Manus, so it might be a bit difficult for him to hear. So he'll speak, and then we'll have a chance for questions from the audience. So we'll sort of do a Q&A, and then we'll say goodbye to Behrouz and move on to the rest of the panel. I'll introduce them a bit later. So is Behrouz on the line? Hello, Behrouz.
Are you there, Behrouz?
Yeah, hello.
Hello. So we are ready for you now.
Yeah.
Thank
hello.
You.
Hello.
Yeah, should I talk?
Yes, please. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, hello, everyone. I would like to thank you for attending this event. Actually, it is a great honor for me to be able to talk with you from Manus Island. I would like to talk about the current situation, and then end up my speech. I would like to raise some questions for civil society in Australia. As you know, we are here for more than 5 years, and still people are living in suffering, in limbo, in Manus Island and Nauru. There are many children in Nauru. Unfortunately, a few days ago I read the news that many people in Australia still don't know that more than 100 children are living in detention in Nauru, and it is actually still, I feel disappointed that after 5 years fighting and after 5 years that we published many news and many stories about Manus Island and Nauru, and we published many documents and even movies. But still people in Australia, many people don't know that children are living in Nauru. So the problem is that the government, is doing propaganda, and unfortunately many people in Australia, they are following the propaganda by the government, and the situation, what is happening and what the Australian government has done on Manus Island and Nauru is, still after 5 years, for me, personally, is unbelievable that how they are doing this kind of thing and how they are keeping children and women in the detention center, in the indefinite detention, in the real prison. Just I would like to give you some information about the current situation. Actually, the situation is getting worse day by day, and we have many problems right now, and we have some people, some serious cases here that most of them are mentally. Two nights ago, a refugee on Port Moresby, the capital city of PNG, he tried to kill himself and do it, and he is in hospital right now. This man was sick for a long time, mentally sick, and we wrote many letters to the authorities that this man is sick and needs to, medical treatment. But they didn't care. They didn't care, so he tried to kill himself. Just to give an example, so we have some very serious cases with mental sickness in Manus Island, and I am sure in Nauru the situation is even worse than Manus, because we are men here, so... But the families are living in Nauru, and also some people who are with, damaged physically, and unfortunately there is not medical facility on Manus Island. Still these people are suffering. Today I found out that it is Father's Day. It's really hard, even for me to imagine that how these people, many people on Manus Island who are father, they are separated with their children for more than 5 years. So I think 5 years is enough to destroy anyone. And these people, I think the fathers are suffering more than other refugees. And, personally, my only dream is to see that day that these people get freedom and they join their family after 5 years. We have some, many young men here. When they exiled them to Manus Island, they were about 20 years old, 21 years old, and now they are 26, 27. And, these people could go to university, they could finish their education, they could do many things, they could have society, but still they are suffering here, and, they damage physically and mentally. And another problem is that the government always say that these people, we are going to send them to America. More than 2 years ago, the Australian Prime Minister announced the deal with America, and they say that, but the problem is that the America deal is a part of the problem right now. And just they are doing interview with people, and the process is very slow. It's very slow, and after more than 2 years, it's still only 100 and 30 people left Manus to America, and many people are remain. So just we are waiting, and we don't know what will happen for us. And another problem with the deal is that the people from banned countries like Iran, Somalia, and Sudan, they don't have any chance. But the government are already silent and doesn't say anything about these people. And as you may know, many people are from this country. Maybe more than 50% of refugees on Manus Island and Nauru are from Somalia, Iran, and Sudan. So, what will happen for them? So, it is really a question, and the problem it is, unfortunately, still people believe in America, and they think that the deal with America is going to work. But unfortunately, this deal and this process is very slow and is damaging people. So imagine some people here that they have been together in a tent or in a room together for more than 5 years. Now they send one of them or two of them to America and another person remains. And they say, you know, have chance. And, you know, already they process us under the international convention, international law, and they already recognize us as a refugee. So it is our right to get freedom. And, the current situation is like this. And also we have many problems on the ground with the local people. The local people are victims under this policy because the media and the government picture them as dangerous people. But I think, the Lorongo town, which is a small town for Manusian people, is with about 3,000 or 2,000 population. So it is natural that when you leave 600 people, 600 strange men in a very small place, small community, of course you have some problems. Just imagine that in a city with 100,000 people population, suddenly you leave 25,000 people in that city. What will happen? So, of course, the people get angry. That city doesn't have this capacity to accept these people and welcome these people. So the situation is like this. And, the governor of Manu, he put a rule that the refugees are not able to leave the detention center, they are allowed to leave the detention center since 8 o'clock at morning until 6 o'clock at evening. So after that, if people go out, they arrest them. And they put a curfew, and it's like a dictatorship. I was born in Iran for 30 years, and I know that what is dictatorship system. So it is completely dictatorship system, and so they are putting pressure on us. I would like to hear your question. If you have any question, I would like to answer. But the current situation is like this. The current situation is getting worse day by day. Yeah, unfortunately, some journalists sometimes they ask, are they giving you enough food? Are they giving you enough clothes? It is actually, this question is like a torture. After 5 years, someone asks you that, because we are not here to get food. We are human and we deserve to get freedom. Still, this system have control on our life. And unfortunately, people in Australia always forget that we are human and we don't want to live in a cage. We don't want to live in limbo and be happy that they are giving us food. We are human and we are deserve to get freedom. Yeah, the big problem, I think, I would like to ask this question from the civil society in Australia. I think we should ask this question, that why the government has this power to keep innocent children, innocent women and families and men in a prison camp for more than 5 years. Why did they have this power? Keep people for more than 5 years. and what is the role of civil society? Yeah, it is a, I think it is a very important question that we should ask and find the answer for it. That how the government has this power to do this. Yeah.
Great, thank you. Thank you so much, Beyrouz. We're now going to have our audience ask you a few questions. So who would like to... Liam?
You need to come
up. To come up.
I see. And just speak quite slowly.
Can you hear me, Beyrouz? Can you hear me, Beyrouz? Beyrouz?
Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Okay. Since I'm the first speaker from the floor, I'm going to take the liberty of just prefacing my question with a comment. You mentioned that what an honour it was for you to speak here. Obviously, for us, it's much more of an honour to be able to listen to you. And that for those of us who have been campaigning against these successive governments in Australia and their racist camps, to see the resistance and the courage and the strength of people like yourself in the camps, especially as we approach the 12-month anniversary of the siege last November, that your resistance and your strength certainly gives us the courage to keep campaigning until all of these grotesque camps are torn down, until all of the refugees are free, until anyone can come here seeking safety.
Unfortunately, I couldn't hear you well.
It was an amazing and articulate comment I made. So, you know. Now, Beyrouz, I wanted to ask you about...
Yeah.
I'm going to try to speak very slow. As you'll know, we've had a change of Prime Minister recently. And Scott Morrison is now the Prime Minister of Australia. And certainly there were people in Australia who... breathed a sigh of relief when that happened because they thought, well, at least it's not Peter Dutton. And I think I'd like to hear, of course, what you have to say about this. Scott Morrison was the immigration minister at the time of the assault, the deadly assault on the Manus Island camp where Reza Barati was killed, over 70 people injured. And I think it's important that we remember his crimes. Could you speak a bit about that and what we should, how we should respond to Scott Morrison, Prime Minister?
Yeah, should I talk about this?
Yeah, it'd be good if you could respond.
Okay. Actually, I explained this question in an article just I released, I think, 2 days ago. And I read some question in my article and I said something in about the history of this policy. I think, the problem is not only a man. The problem is not, only an individual person like Peter Dutton or, Scott Morrison. But what I am understanding, is that Scott Morrison has a big role, an important role, to establish this system, to establish this policy. And unfortunately, the, both parties always support this policy. And I think both, in my perspective, both parties are criminal, Labour and Liberal, and they should answer. So the problem is that the opposition and the Bill Shorten, always, over the past 5 years, they have supported this policy and they give, superpower to Peter Dutton to do this kind of thing. So the problem is that the system. So that's why I think, for the refugees, nothing changed. Over the past 5 years, we experienced 3 prime ministers. You know, first Kevin Rudd, Israel also here, then Tony Abbott, then Martin Turnbull, and now Scott Morrison. We have experienced 4 prime ministers, and many things change. Many, political things change in Australia, but nothing changed for us, and still we are here. So that's why the refugees, are disappointed with this kind of thing, and they are disappointed with, actually, it's not important for us that who is in power and who is prime minister, who is immigration minister. The problem is that the both parties are supporting this policy. But in my view, I think that any change is good. And a situation like this before the federal election, I think, I hope that this change, getting, finally end up in, getting freedom for us. And I think we have some, we are in a very important situation like this, very, historical period for us in history of Manus prison and Nauru prison. And I hope that we get freedom in this election, the coming election. And I hope that, the civil society puts pressure, more pressure on the government to let us go. And the problem is that we don't want to go to Australia. Just we are asking that let us go. And many people say that why you don't leave Manus and Nauru? Because the government doesn't allow us. It's easy for me to get some sponsorship from, other countries or other refugees. It's easy for us to get visa from other countries. But the problem is that the government doesn't allow us to leave. So it is a big problem. It's a big problem. And I think, we are disappointed with any, political change in Australia. So just we should wait. We should wait. And unfortunately, the situation is like this. And, what did I say in my article? I say that why the Australian people should always, select and choose between bad and worse. Mm-hmm. Why is like this? Mm-hmm. And I think many people in Australia are disappointed with this government as well. Mm-hmm. So we are like the people in Australia.
Well, Beirut talks about an article that he has recently had published in The Guardian. I really encourage everyone to look it up. It's about why Australia needs a moral revolution. He makes the case in that about that Scott Morrison, people shouldn't be relieved that he's some kind of moderate. He's actually cut from the same cloth just as much toying with far-right ideologies as Peter Dutton. Another question.
Thank you, Beirut. My question is about something else you say, you describe in your book. You put it very wonderfully, yeah. I think, where you talk about how imprisoning people on Nauru is part of a same process and a same system which imprisons all of us here in Australia as well. And I wonder if you could explain that point a bit more. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. So I use some main concepts in my book, which is hierarchical system and also systematic torture. So actually, I wrote the book on based off these two main concepts. So what is hierarchical system? Hierarchical system, I think, it is a system that puts people, is torturing people through rules. putting people through some way to make them angry and torture them, but in a soft way, in a soft way. So this concept that I use in the book, I think, take my book, they take the Manus prison to, you know, Australia, and it's saying that this prison and, you know, the, you know, creating this prison, the reason is beyond Manus Island, and it roots in Australia. So we should find our answer in, you know, the educational system in Australia and the history of, you know, political culture in Australia. And, you know, we can see that the system that is torturing people on Manus Island, we can see some similarity between this system and in, you know, Australian hospitals, Australian universities, or Australian, you know, the other structures. So there are some similarities. So what did I do? Just 2 weeks ago, I published an article and I, you know, compared my book with the movie I, Daniel Blake. So I compared these two things. I don't know that people watch this movie or not, but, you know, in the movie, it is about the society and how the government is, you know, trying to, you know, put the vulnerable people and poor people and, you know, the people with disability through a system that, you know, torture them, and the government put people through a situation that they, you know, don't suffer them. So I think this book is very important because this book is saying that we should find the roots in Australia. And I am sure in Australia, you know, I am watching Australia from this island. Over the past 5 years, the government cut the, you know, support for the vulnerable people, for, you know, the people who are living in poverty, the people with disability, you know, the most vulnerable people in the society. And the government are always, day by day, is making the situation hard for them. You know, we can't say that the government is, you know, trying to, you know, leave these people without any problems in the society. And it is very dangerous. It is very dangerous. So the government is doing this through a way that is torturing people on Manus Island and Nauru. So that's why I think, you know, actually my English is not enough strong to explain this, but I would like to ask people to read the book because I explain and I describe life and this system, how this system is working in my book. And if people read the book, they can get the answer. That's why I think this book is very important. And it is not only about Manus and it's not only about Nauru. This book is about Australia. And it is about the Australian society. So people, by reading this book, are able to find some, you know, similarity between the Manus prison system and the system in Australia. That's how they are, you know, put the vulnerable people in Australian society through, you know, very hard situation.
Okay, we have time for one more.
Yeah.
Beirut is just coming down.
Just say a few words in Farsi, then we go English. سلام بهروز جان. من بهروزم. الان چند تا چیز از برات بهت میگم. I'm just very emotional now when I talk to you. I talked to you about half an hour ago, but still I just feeling for you, brother. And everyone in this room, I think all of them love you and love all people, the refugees are there, and they are fighting for you. And they, every time we got a protest and this stuff, we coming for you and we coming fighting for you people. But one of the things I just want to ask you, you are a prisoner for 5 years, and I've been a prisoner for a few years before, what keep you in this very horrible situation in there? And always, you know, sometimes you cannot see any future in the horizon, but you are still fighting and fighting. You are a fighter, you are a Kurd, you know, you're always mentioning your identity as a Kurd journalist. And you've been suppressed in Iran as a Kurd. You fight there, you flee there because you couldn't stand, you know, because, you know, you get in the prison or something like that. And then you come in here for the freedom, and they keep you in the prison again, and you fight in there. Just could you explain a little bit about your situation and how you can keep up in this horrible system and situation? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, I know that many people in Australia, you know, are standing for refugees, are, you know, against this barbaric policy. And I think it's so valuable that still many people in Australia are, you know, not happy with this situation and this policy. Actually, you know, this system, you know, as I described in my book, designed to humiliate people. It's designed to take our identity and reduce us to some numbers. Still, they are calling us by numbers. And, you know, this system designed to take our identity. And I think, you know, what I am doing and what I have tried to do is to do some work opposite of this system and take our identity and take our humanity back. So what I am trying to say is to, you know, front up a system that is taking our identity. We are trying to take our identity back. And, you know, if you follow my work, always I try to show our humanity face and show that we are human. So, as you know, human is not angel, human is not ego. We are human. You know, it's very simple. We are human like all the people around the world, like people in Australia. So always I try to, you know, writing and creating art is a way that I survive. So it is a way that I always try to survive through my writing. So that's why I think, you know, I am able to, you know, fight, feel I am alive, because when I am fighting, when I am writing, I feel that still I am a human, still I am, you know, I am alive. So, yeah, if you read the book, you can see that all the system is to take our identity, take our... But I think, you know, identity is a concept that when I was born in Kurdistan as a Kurd, you know, always it was a big challenge for me, because in Iran the situation for the system for the Kurd people is like this, that always the system is, you know, try to take our identity, take the Kurdish people's identity. And I think the history of Kurdistan is like this, the court people are fighting to get freedom, to fight to get, you know, to keep their culture, their culture alive. So I think we cannot separate, you know, my way. And, you know, I did too many serious projects, like a movie, Chokra, Prince of Sultan, and also this book. So in both projects, I put some Kurdish cultural elements in the both of my projects, because I have, I committed to keep the Kurdish culture alive, and it is a part of my identity. So even in some work that I do for, you know, against Australia in this island and about Manus prison, you can see that in other sites, this kind of works are for, you know, keeping Kurdish culture alive and promote Kurdish culture. So you cannot separate these things.
Thank you so much, Beirut. Encourage everybody to read his important book, both about the incredible oppressive, torturous nature of the prison system on Manus, but also an argument about the incredible humanity of people on the island, and which was really documented as well in his film Shawka, Please Tell Us the Time, which everyone should also watch. And there's a beautiful scene in that of Beirut singing a Kurdish song, a song of resistance. So I think it would be nice to say goodbye with a chant to express our solidarity with your struggle for freedom.
And yeah, thank you.
So a chant that we always have at our protests is "Free, free the refugees." So it'd be good if everyone could chant that with me. Yeah.
Free, free the refugees! 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 Free, free the refugees!
Thank you so much, Beirut,
yeah,
for joining
you.
Us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll speak again.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, we now have two more people on the panel to talk about the struggle for refugee freedom. The first one I'm going to introduce is Aaron Mulvaganam. Aaron is a Tamil refugee, and he is also founder and spokesperson of the Tamil Refugee Council, which is now a national organisation that's been doing some very important work, because the Tamil refugee population are particularly in the crosshairs of the Australian state. Massive rates of deportations are happening, and so it's very important the work that they're doing to try and organise the Tamil community, but also to try and highlight their cases, to try and resist and stop their deportations back to danger. So welcome.
Thank you, Liz. It is hard to follow such an act by Burroughs.
Why did you do that? Sorry, not you.
Should I continue? Yeah.
Yeah.
As Burroughs said, we have got a prime minister who's not the only one who's responsible for the situation refugees are in now. It is part of a system. But I want to go through some of the things that our Prime Minister did while he was Immigration Minister, and then I do want to look at what the Labor Party has done as well, and the way forward. As a member of Tamil Refugee Council, I have personally witnessed the brutal force Scott Morrison used towards refugees. While Morrison tortured refugees on Manus and Nauru, he was also one of the biggest supporters of the murderous Rajapaksa regime in Sri Lanka, a government that murdered over 100,000 Tamils in May 2009, enjoyed the support of liberal leadership. Scott Morrison frequently visited Sri Lanka and tried to help whitewash the crimes of the Sri Lankan state. As a shadow minister for immigration, Scott Morrison provided or promised to provide diplomatic and financial support to the Sri Lankan government in return for cooperation on stopping Tamil refugees fleeing the country. The liberal leadership promised to work with the Rajapaksa government. They lied on national media about their meetings with Tamil leadership in Sri Lanka and claimed Tamils were safe. In February 2013, Morrison actually told Australian media outlets after meeting with Rajapaksa and Sri Lankan Army and Navy commanders that he would send every Tamil refugee who arrived in Australia back to Sri Lanka. Soon after Liberal government got elected in 2013, September 2013, at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Colombo, Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott enlightened the world about Australia's approach to the evil practices of the Sinhala Chauvinists. Abbott said, when journalists asked about torture in Sri Lanka, Tony Abbott, at the end of 2013, said, "In difficult circumstances, difficult things happen." As Immigration Minister, Morrison also maintained this message. In April 2014, he actually welcomed Gotabaya Rajapaksa, the most feared man in Sri Lanka, for the first time in Australia. That was his first visit to a Western country. Rajapaksa, as Defence Secretary, also oversaw the killings in 2009, and our Prime Minister was happy to rub shoulders with the mass murderer under investigation by the United Nations for war crimes. He actually signed agreements which were going to lead to mass deportations of Tamils, and this created fear in the Tamil refugee community and led to many suicide attempts. And one of that is the death of Leo Seemanpilla. I witnessed it firsthand, the cold-blooded Morrison who'd lied through his teeth. When Leo Seemanpilla self-immolated in Geelong and died on 1st of June 2014, I was actually by Leo's bedside when he took the last breath. And at that time, Morrison lied about contacting Leo's family and offering support. He stooped to a new low by refusing Leo's parents to come and be part of their son's funeral. In fact, his brother, who had the documents, he was told he was denied visa because Scott Morrison feared he would overstay his visa. And despite all this, Leo actually donated all his organs. Five of his organs were donated to fellow Australians. Again, in July 2014, Morrison ordered the detaining of Tamil refugees at sea for over a month and the attempt to deliver 157 Tamils back into the hands of the Sri Lankan government. A two-year-old baby, Febrina, was kidnapped on high seas and kept there for over a month before a High Court injunction forced the government to bring the refugees to mainland. They were subsequently taken to Nauru. Now, following up on what Beru said, Morrison didn't act alone when it came to abusing refugees. What I was observing as a refugee activist, he was part of this axis of evil within the Liberal Party to which Tony Abbott and Julie Bishop played a key role. They were equally committed to the violence against refugees. I must also say these trio were very effective in opposition as well. They created fear in the community and forced the Labour Party to adopt their policies. I mean, this is not to deny the racist views held by the Labour leadership, but also a Whig leadership of Rudd and Gillard government had no interest in showing compassion towards refugees. They didn't want to be the one explaining to the Australian public why refugees were coming into this country. They wanted to look tough on refugees. As they got tougher, conservatives attacked them for being soft and so on. They were desperate to hold on to power at any expense. A minority Gillard government with Bill Shorten as a key backer and with the support of the Greens went to another level in its cruelty towards refugees. It was really chaotic. We had many, mainly Tamil refugees, indefinitely detained on security grounds. The enhanced screening process was introduced where over 1,500 Tamils at the end of 2012 and early 2013 were deported back without even their claims being assessed. And I still remember Bob Carr as Foreign Minister, while visiting Sri Lanka in December 2012, threatened human rights groups from speaking out against the human rights record of the Sri Lankan government. And it was under the Gillard government we saw Ranjini in Sydney, a pregnant Tamil mother, indefinitely detained and forced to give birth to her third son, surrounded by Serco guards. Even her husband was not allowed to go into the maternity ward. And Morrison and Dutton took these barbaric acts of the Labour government to a whole new level. Today, we see how refugees are being mistreated, especially on Nauru and Manus. And in the mainland Australia, we're seeing refugees being deported every week to danger. We saw in February how the case of Sandra Rubin, how a Tamil refugee who had evidences of torture, who had evidences that he would face certain danger, was deported back. He was deported back with approval from the United Nations. After a protest action by anti-deportation activists, Sandra Rubin was actually driven all the way from Melbourne to Sydney. And from at the Sydney airport, he was forced to sign the voluntary deportation documents and deported on AirAsia flight. We saw how a Tamil family with two children from Bilavila were ripped apart and taken back into detention in March. Piriya, who fled Sri Lanka after her fiancé was burnt alive together with five other men in her village, was denied protection visa. They've been in detention for the last 6 months. Doctors at the Royal Children Hospital recently told the family that the two children, one is 3 years old and another is 1 year old, are starting to show symptoms of PTSD. And just last month, another Tamil refugee here in Sydney was separated from his newborn child and wife and deported back. Kartika and her 10-month-old child was begging for help outside the Villawood Detention Centre when Diliban was deported back. And this time we actually had the support from the UN. We had the UNHCR office in Canberra tried to get in touch with Peter Dutton, but they couldn't. You know, the AFL boss have better access to Peter Dutton,
yeah,
the United Nations for Refugees. These deportations ruining people's lives are likely to escalate in the coming days and weeks under Scott Morrison. We will need a real force to fight back. We have a weak leadership in Labour Party. We have a trade union movement that is committed to getting the Labour Party elected and wouldn't question Bill Shorten on refugees. As polls point to a Shorten Labour government, we are not likely to see a change in Stop the Boats policy. Every progressive force within the Labour Party has gone silent on refugees. The refugee movement relied on people like Jed Carney to pressure Shorten to change his policy. Jed Carney, in the recent weeks, has sent a clear message that she is not interested in pressuring Bill Shorten. When she was given with an opportunity to oppose the government's policy on refugees, she stood on the side of Peter Dutton and voted with the government to attack refugees. And then she had the audacity to go on social media to justify her action by claiming she's trying to work within the Labour Party and not upset anyone. In fact, that week, I actually organized Kartika and her 10-month-old child to meet with Jed Carney in Canberra. This meeting was organized 3 weeks in advance. We hoped this meeting meant that newly elected Labour government would bring the Taliban back. Kartika traveled all the way from Sydney for 4 hours by car to meet Jed Carney, and Jed Carney could only meet her for 10 minutes. Because she had to catch a flight. Either a refugee movement has made a calculated error in relying on certain people in the union movement to pressure Bill Shorten, or else people within the union movement, within the progressive elements, within the Labour Party, has taken the refugee movement for a ride. Michelle O'Neill, who is now the president of ACTU, unions such as the RTBU, my union, and many others, has in the past declared support for the refugee movement. In Victoria, we now find these people in the industrial left faction, which was recently formed to provide numbers for Bill Shorten. In fact, this mob actually ensured refugee issue was not discussed at the state conference in Victoria. Friends, the refugee movement faces an uphill battle within the Labour Party, within the union movement, and outside of it in the absence of a mass movement. We have to build an alternative force that the major parties will take notice of. In the absence of it, we face a prolonged struggle. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Aaron, for giving quite an important argument, I think, to the room about the nature, I guess, of the forces that we're up against. Not just the Liberal Party, but the Labour Party as well, and making a really important case about the need for an independent mass movement on the streets that doesn't have any truck of just, if we just appeal and lobby the Labour Party, it will change things, that we actually need to get out on the streets in our numbers if we're going to force through any genuine change on this issue. So our next speaker is Harsha. Harsha is a member of Socialist Alternative. She's also the National Union of Students Anti-Racism Officer. She's been organising some important actions, not only around refugee rights, but standing up generally against the vile racism of the Australian state. So welcome, Harsha.
Thanks, Liz, and thanks, Aaron and Berries. It's certainly hard not to be a bit emotional while hearing the words of people who are fighting this every day. And I just wanted to zoom out a bit and talk about the global situation. I think when we're talking about refugees, we're confronted with a horrific figure. At the end of 2017, there were 68.5 million people displaced globally, according to the UNHCR. For scale, that's 2¾ times the population of this whole country that are stateless, who've lost their homes. They may be on the run, starving, or at risk of death. The zones of displacement are the places that humanity has totally abandoned. As the world has watched on, thousands have been killed by raining bullets and white phosphorus in Aleppo. Cities have become just a shell of their former selves in Syria, and half the country's population has been displaced by the violence of Assad's dictatorship, backed up by Russian air power. Afghanistan, a place where the Australian military has a long-term involvement, that's an ongoing crisis zone. However, it is considered to be safe by countries such as Sweden, this despite over 3,000 deaths in conflict there in 2017, and they're deporting refugees back to Afghanistan. These are places where the impoverished live. Those who say that capitalism has raised the living standards of everybody have absolutely nothing to say about these places. For example, last year the word got out about the horrors that were visited and continue to be visited upon the Rohingya people in Myanmar. This happens while the Australian government, like in Sri Lanka, stands by, while Myanmar's political leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, is held up as a hero of peace and democracy. The world we live in is extremely twisted and warped. This is a global issue, not just because of the scale and not just because of the paths that refugees forge in their flight across borders, across continents and across oceans. In our globalised world, the political elite learn from each other new refined methods of cruelty and egg each other on in racist scapegoating. Just a month ago, after being detained in the US, a small child died as a result of possible negligent care and a respiratory illness she contracted from one of the other children. Does this sound familiar? Because it's the exact recipe for murder on Manus Island and Nauru. Medical neglect and bureaucratic stalling, of which 12 people have died so far. And actually, it's now getting worse. What's happening to children on Nauru makes you sick to the stomach. Last week, a 12-year-old child tried to set herself alight in an attempt to escape it all. Children as young as 12 are experiencing resignation syndrome, a condition born of sheer hopelessness. It was observed in prisoners of the Nazi concentration camps as a complete inability to engage with the world, refusing to speak, then eat, ending with them lying prone, unable to move. The Australian government consciously uses this cruelty, what Behrers called earlier the Manus dictatorship, as a way of deterring others from coming here. In the words of Peter Dutton, whose prime ministership we've barely sidestepped, this is a success that could be undone overnight in a single act of compassion. Showing humanity to refugees transgresses too far the racist laws that govern this country, so that when 20 refugees, Vietnamese refugees, made their way onto Australian soil in the Daintree after their boat capsized earlier this week, the government immediately started searching for a way to round them up and send them offshore. Our new Prime Minister Scott Morrison said that a ban on travel from Muslim countries instituted by the Trump administration shows just how much the world is catching up to Australia. This, along with Trump's words to ex-Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull that the Australian government is worse than I am, shows how the baseline of how human beings can be treated is constantly being undercut by those who run this world. It also illustrates that the sensible centre of politics that Turnbull is supposed to represent has been just as culpable for all of this as the psychopathic right in the form of Peter Dutton. We have to see this as not just a horrifying indictment of humanity, but an indictment on the system of global capitalism and its political rulers. This atrocity on Manus and Nauru is not an isolated phenomenon, but something that can only be understood and combated by seeing its connection to a world order. Because 68.5 million refugees is a humanitarian crisis, to be sure. However, the way that borders divide up the world and the cruelty that faces refugees is not a failure of humanity, I would argue. It's the system that's failing the vast majority of human beings on this planet. This system is designed to only serve a minority of people, and it is this minority that is inhumane. A minority that gets rich at the expense of most of the people on this planet. Donald Trump, Peter Dutton, Scott Morrison and the rest, they are definitely not embodiments of humanity. They are part of this minority, and we should see their actions as such. They don't commit these crimes against humanity out of blindness, out of a lack of moral fibre or a lack of understanding of the consequences. I don't think we can open their eyes or shock them into doing the right thing. The political elite that oversees this system does this with their eyes far wide open, and they spend billions of dollars to achieve it. They set up barbed wire fences that are guarded by heavily armed border police. They send immigration officials to racially profile and terrify whole communities. They make sure every loophole in refugee law is closed and stake their political careers on stopping the boats. And they willfully lie about children overboard, people smugglers and Muslims. They set up concentration camps in mosquito-ridden climes, and they damn well make sure that there's no cooling, no ventilation, no clean water, no medical facilities, and that the guards can be relied upon to dehumanise their inhabitants. And this is also the case for the Labour Party, which Aaron went over, which in government did not lose their moral compass as much as betray that they never had one. Gillard reopened the Nauru Processing Centre as a deliberate racist strategy. Rudd announced a PNG solution for the same reason. And they are not captive to the racist vote. They do this regardless of how they are sailing in the polls. Because for all of them, there's a higher principle than humanity. Humanity, for them, is something to be sacrificed at the altar of profit. And they'll do whatever it takes to achieve that. They'll rob from the poor to pay for tax cuts for the greediest corporations. That's just a power of course. Bombing and invading to grab resources is just a necessary part of the job. If it means cozying up to or installing dictators or cooperating with regimes, carrying out genocides, so be it. And they devise endless means to disguise or legitimise their agenda. And I think racism is a key part of this. The great black abolitionist Frederick Douglass wasn't wrong to say that they divide both to conquer each. In order to subjugate us all, they endlessly subdivide humanity by gender, by sexuality, by age and ability, and importantly, by race and by nation, which is becoming an increasingly and powerful and important division for this 1% to maintain. And this is in no way natural. Borders are only as old as the system itself, and racism ebbs and flows depending on what's useful for our rulers in maintaining it. Borders seem to be less important for giant coal mines sponsored by billionaires like Adani. Or, speaking of Peter Dutton, what's the go with the au pairs? The French nannies for cashed-up Liberal Party donors don't have the racist laws applied to them. It's a bit rough for the AFL bosses who they're working for. You knew it was election season in the lead-up to the Super Saturday by-elections because the Liberals started ramping up their fear-mongering about African gangs, even though sometimes they forgot their lines, like Christopher Pyne did. Refugees are scapegoated for all the ills of society that the elite is responsible for. In New South Wales, the Labor Party has been pushing this most of all. They've been running a fear campaign against immigrants, saying that Sydney is overrun. Scott Morrison has a track record of advocating for increasing Islamophobia in order to win votes. In 2011, he said that the coalition should capitalise concerns about Muslim immigration and the inability of Muslims to integrate. So the racism directed towards refugees is part of violently reinforcing a system that at its heart is about the rule of the wealthy. Burries' analysis, I think, and comparison with the welfare system that destroys the main character in I, Daniel Blake, is really apt and illustrates this. And I just wanted to read a word from the article the article he referenced. What takes place in the prisons on Manus and Nauru is, in fact, the perfect manifestation of a system that strips human beings of their personhood and autonomy. Recently, we've seen a real sharpening of racist rhetoric and policy. Capitalism is getting progressively worse, even for the working class inhabitants of Western countries. The only thing that capitalists have to offer in this void is, as a salve, is intense nationalism and racism so that they can exert greater control over society. In this, people like Trump and other far-right leaders have been pushing hard towards this racist authoritarianism, and other sections of the political elite, as I said, have been more than willing to follow them. The new Morrison government is a fresh shift to the right and is a reflection of these developments overseas as well. And I think the situation is truly urgent. So the question remains, how do we stop this? I think this is a political problem. Things don't have to be like this. The structures of this existing society deserve to be and must be questioned. We can't accept borders and the violence needed to maintain them as permanent or inevitable. And yes, society is hurtling headlong towards the right, but this is not something beyond change. I think we need to throw a spanner in the works. Like Yelen Ersin on the plane from Gothenburg to Istanbul, if people saw that. A young Swedish woman boarded an international flight intending to stop it from leaving with a refugee from Afghanistan on board. She said, "It felt like that when I saw the family crying and I didn't know if I was going to be able to do it. But I knew I couldn't back down because it was my name that was on the ticket. I had to do what I could." Yelen's courage to put herself out there and take a stand is what we all need if we're going to stop this cruelty. Moreover, I think we need politics that can transcend the twisted logic that's handed down to us by our rulers and their supporters. Politics that recognises that it's the inhumanity of our rulers that's responsible for what we see. Politics that's not afraid to be uncivil, to break the rules in order to win the fight. Politics that sees the collective struggle of ordinary people as the key to victory. We've seen examples of how this can be possible, even in these recent bleak times. Half the residents in a small French village called, my French is awful, Folamontagne, fought police to stop the newest members of their community, four Sudanese refugees, who had endured months of slavery in Libya before arriving in France, from being deported. They got organised in meetings and with petitions and organised demonstrations of heaps of people in the village that eventually saved the refugees from having to go to Italy where they first landed, where their asylum request would certainly have been denied. In cities and towns across America, the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials have come across ordinary people, students, workers and others, blocking their access to immigrants that they want to deport. And now the demand to abolish ICE altogether is resoundingly popular. This in Trump's America. On our home soil, as Aaron went over, even in small country towns like Bilawala, not so dissimilar to where I grew up, where a young Tamil family settled a few years ago, there are people outraged that the government wants to steal away their friends and neighbours. Thousands of people have organised, signed petitions, rallied and protested to get the word out about Priya Nadas and their children who are still at risk of deportations. And in our history, we've got a history of anti-racist organising in the progressive and union movements here in Australia. Unions in this country fought against apartheid South Africa. I was just speaking to some people earlier about how the unions in Wollongong actually desegregated all of those communities. They were racially segregated towards Indigenous people. I think it's that we have to channel and we have to learn the lessons from. And that is that ordinary people around the world show humanity where our rulers are utterly incapable. Our rulers have too much of a vested interest in racism to willingly break from it. We need to organise a collective struggle that can challenge the racist consensus and, moreover, offer an alternative vision from the landscape of austerity and endless privation that we're just supposed to accept as workers. We can fight for a society where the needs of everybody are fulfilled, where want and misery are a thing of the past. For that, we'll need to build towards a workers' movement that can answer all of these questions. And every act of disobedience to this racist system helps to begin this fight.